Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Introducing Anabe Sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabe sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off, plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Hello, and welcome to this next episode of Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams, because I thought we could do with a change from Martians, kings, and colonialism. So this time we're just going to bring it down to ground level and talk about a play that really is just all about family, not in like a sort of, you know, lame, Fast and Furious sort of way, but genuine family, real family. Before we do get into this particular play itself, though, I actually just want to spend just a few minutes talking about theatre generally, because actually, aside from discussing Shakespeare plays, I've not actually so far talked about just theatre. And so I don't want this to bleed too heavily over, but it's a good opportunity now, given that this is the first singular play that we're actually discussing here on Chronicles. The misconception with theatre, which is entirely informed by just contemporary examples and, you know, the modern times that we live in, where theatre and actors generally seem to consider themselves vanguards of progressivism, you know, at the first frontiers of all social change, and basically all of that change kind of sucks and is bad. But fundamentally, theatre has always had a political bent to it, even going back, you know, the days, of course, of ancient Greece with playwrights such as Aristophanes, who we'll get to in a few chronicles' time. But theatre makers, writers are really just always reacting to whatever the social circumstances, what the, you know, the state of society at the time in which the playwright is writing. And you have with this certain playwrights, such as those from the Soviet Union, who were, of course, writing under very, very censorious conditions. But, you know, in their hearts, they were anti-communists. And so we'll get to playwrights like that further down the line. But a lot of, you know, playwrights and actors and theatre practitioners were sent to the gulag, right, for not being sufficiently communist enough, many such cases, as it were, back then. But also the fact that we seem to be in an age where everything has to have an opinion, right? Everything has to have a political purpose to it. And some of the best theatre is that where you can just go and spend an afternoon and be entertained. And I actually think that you should judge any creative endeavour, whether it's a novel or a play, primarily, first and foremost, by its merits as literature, as a read, as a story, more than any actual analysis that you will put on it afterwards, right? It's, did it feel like 4 hours, or was it just a really, really good 2 hours that left me wanting more? Was that novel a real page-turner? That, first and foremost, is, of course, the hallmark of good writing. and the one that should always be at the forefront of the mind before any theory or political application or social reading gets put on top afterwards. So with all this said, let's begin to talk about The Glass Menagerie and Tennessee Williams as a playwright and as a life. Tennessee Williams was born in Mississippi in 1911. He was born Thomas Lanier Williams. Williams was a man who grew up on Shakespeare, grew up on Dickens. Those were the first two loves, literary loves of his life, and everything else sort of fell forward from there. But he didn't really have a happy childhood or a very happy adolescence at all, really. There was a lot of misery, a lot of abuse, and a lot of control in Williams's very, very early life. His father was Cornelius Williams, and his mother was Edwina. His father was anything but paternal, and his mother was anything but maternal. Cornelius was abusive. He was absent, and also when he was at home, it was hell at the same time. He was not good company to be around. He sounds like he was just quite a wretch of a human being. And conversely, his mother was always at home, but she, in her own way, was very manipulative, very domineering, very zealous, religiously zealous. And I've no doubt that these harsh, you know, decrees of order on William's life is what led him to living such a libertine existence once he broke free of it and was out there in the world making his own fortune and making his own way in life. But beyond his parents, there is also just one other person that's very, very key to his life that is worth addressing before we get into the play itself, and that was his sister Rose. Now, Rose was, I believe, slightly older than William, slightly the elder child, but Tennessee Williams actually had a very, very good relationship with his sister Rose, who he loved very, very dearly. And unfortunately, this one good thing, even in itself, was ruined and taken away from him. When Rose was in her late teenage years, she seemed to develop all of the hallmarks of schizophrenia or something of the kind, right? Just really, really severe episodes, you know, changes in mood, aggression, and she was eventually taken into a mental asylum. And the year before The Glass Menagerie was first performed, in 1944, the year before that, in 43, Rose, his sister, was actually lobotomized in this mental institution. And so, of course, after a horrible backward procedure like that, she was, of course, never the same again. And any evidence of even those purer moments of heart that she'd once possessed were replaced by this tranquil state. You see pictures from before people have been lobotomized versus what they're like after. And it's a marked difference. You can see the change behind the eyes. You know, all of a sudden there seems to be less of a soul there. It's a very, very grim thing to observe. Moving forward then, let's start to talk about the play itself. In some ways, it's very by the numbers. Dealing with family is a very, very old thing. People have been writing about family for almost as long as they've been writing. But also in many ways, Tennessee Williams brings into this play a lot of 20th century technology, such as a screen that would have had a projector to enhance the imagery of the play and act as a prop of its own. And he also brought music to it as well. There's a musical motif that's supposed to play this theme of the Glass Menagerie, which is very, very delicate and adds a certain atmosphere to scenes involving Laura, the sister, in the play. But other than that, it is a memory. It's called a memory play, and it's the first of its kind in that respect. This is the first memory play that we have, and really that just simply is a framing device. It's a device by which Tennessee Williams frames the action of the play, and so you've got Tom, and it's him at the start of the play remembering these events back to himself. And we'll get into more of what the implications of that are once we've gone through the actual overview of the plot itself. The play begins in St. Louis, Missouri, in the 1930s, where the Wingfield family lives. Amanda, the mother, and her two children, Tom and Laura. Their father left home 16 years ago when they were very young, and the Wingfield apartment is in the rear of the building in what is described as one of those hive-like conglomerations of cellular living units that flower as warty growths in overcrowded urban centres of lower middle-class populations. The apartment faces an alley and is entered by a fire escape. The play is a memory, which, as Williams assures us, means that it is therefore non-realistic. Memory takes a lot of poetic license. It omits some details. Others are exaggerated, according to the emotional value of the articles it touches. For memory is seated predominantly in the heart. Tom walks on stage, dressed as a merchant sailor. He speaks directly to the audience, telling them about the characters that they will meet in the play, and the one that we won't, his father. A telephone man who fell in love with long distances, such as Mexico. Tom then steps into the memory, and the story begins in earnest. Mother and children are at home, and Tom is told to come to a table by his mother. She tells him not to push his food with his fingers, to chew, to not smoke as much. Amanda demands Laura stay at the table in case some gentlemen callers come and visit. The mother then tells her children, whether they care to listen or not, of the story she has told them many times before, of her days of youth at Blue Mountain, Mississippi, as a Southern belle. She recounts the attention she'd had from these gentlemen callers. She recounts who they were, the lives they'd gone on to live or didn't live, and the ones who got away, and how instead of them, she'd fallen for their absent father and his charm. But Laura is not her mother, and weakly says that she should not expect any visitors. In the next scene, Tom is at work, having a lowly job at the shoemaking factory, and Laura sits at home at the typewriter. Laura is a gentle, fragile soul. Without confidence or purpose, she spends her days hoodwinking her mother into thinking that she's attending Rubicam's business school. It is a comfort to her mother that, even if her daughter cannot seem to find looking love, she at least has a prospect of a job. But even this hope is broken when Amanda learns that Laura hasn't been attending her classes for over 6 weeks. Instead, she spent her days walking, visiting museums, filling her hours with footsteps that are leading nowhere and thoughts that create no future. It is revealed to the audience that the reason for this is that Laura is crippled, a word that her mother refuses to use. As a child, she wore a leg brace, metallic and clanking. It came to define her childhood, setting her apart from the other children. Self-consciousness led to isolation. Isolation led to shyness, and shyness left her detached from society and its demands. Her mother tries to give her a reality check. So, what are we going to do for the rest of our lives? Stay home and watch the parades go by? Amuse ourselves with the glass menagerie, darling? Eternally play those worn-out phonograph records your father left as a painful reminder of him? We won't have a business career. We've given that up because it gave us nervous indigestion. What is there left but dependency all our lives? I know so well what becomes of unmarried women who aren't prepared to occupy a position. I've seen such pitiful cases in the South. Barely tolerated spinsters living upon the grudging patronage of sisters' husbands or brothers' wives. Stuck away in some little mousetrap of a room, encouraged by one in-law to visit another. Little bird-like women without any nest, eating the crust of humility all their lives. Is that the future we've mapped out for ourselves? I swear, it's the only alternative I can think of. Of course, some girls do marry. This leads Laura to recollect a boy from high school that she'd once had a crush on. She remembers his operatic voice, his grin, his name for her, Blue Roses. But his girlfriend had been the best-dressed girl in school, and Laura could never hope to compete for his attention. Seasons pass, And to make extra money, Amanda tries to telephone for potential subscribers to a magazine. In her usual overbearing manner, she smothers Tom with criticisms until he needs to go out and go to the movies. He goes there often, and his mother doesn't trust him. Where does he really go? Who does he really see? What poor life choices does he make out there in the world beyond their fire escape door? In the world beyond Amanda's control? Tom snaps. Listen, you think I'm crazy about the warehouse? You think I'm in love with the Continental Shoemakers? You think I want to spend 55 years down there in that Celotex interior with fluorescent tubes? Look, I'd rather somebody pick up a crowbar and battered out my brains and go back mornings. I go. Every time you come in yelling that, goddamn, rise and shine, rise and shine, I say to myself, how lucky dead people are. But I get up. I go. For $65 a month, I give up all that I dream of doing and being ever. And then, to torture his mother and play into the fears of his nocturnal activities, he jokes, I'm going to opium dens. Yes, opium dens of vice and criminal hangouts, mother. I've joined the Hogan Gang. I'm a hired assassin. I carry a Tommy gun in a violin case. I run a string of cat houses in the valley. They call me Killer, Killer Wingfield. I'm leading a double life, a simple, honest warehouse worker by day, by night, a dynamic czar of the underworld. Mother, they're going to blow us all sky high some night. I'll be glad, very happy, and so will you. You'll go up on a broomstick over Blue Mountain with 17 gentlemen callers, you ugly, babbling old witch. Naturally, this leaves mother and son on rather sour terms. But even more egregiously, in his haste and rage, he accidentally knocks over one of Laura's glass animals from her menagerie, leaving her distraught. Later that night, Tom returns, drunk. Very drunk, in fact. But against the prison of home, it only validates his longing to escape, for adventure. He's seen travel logs, Mickey Mouse, musicians, and an organ solo, all from the comfort of a cinema and a night out in St. Louis. What adventures could he have if he went further than that? If he abandoned his commitments to his family? If he was like his father? His key falls through the crack in the floor, but fortunately, Laura is awake and lets him in. And it's clear in her care for him that this familial love is very strong and one of the key reasons that Tom stays. In fact, the only thing that keeps Tom there. Morning breaks. Rise and shine! Bellows the mother, who had only been told the night before how much the son hates that ritual. They will not speak to one another, only childishly passing messages through Laura until Laura leaves to go to the shop. And this allows a moment for Amanda and Tom to reconcile. Amanda beseeches her son to find a young gentleman of good morals at the factory that she can invite to dinner and set up with Laura. And begrudgingly, Tom agrees to it. When he returns, he tells his mother that he's invited a work colleague, Jim O'Connor, a shipping clerk on a slightly better salary than Tom, and he'll come to visit tomorrow evening. But Amanda laments that it's all too sudden. Nevertheless, she cleans and prepares and gives Laura one of her old dresses from a now long-lost age of antebellum elegance. The stage notes detail that Laura's hair is changed. It is softer and more becoming, a fragile, unearthly prettiness that comes out in Laura. She's like a piece of translucent glass touched by light, given a momentary radiance, not actual, not lasting. As Laura's mother readies her with extra padding for her breasts and the obligatory stories about her own youth, and then she tells Laura the name of her gentleman caller, Jim O'Connor. Laura is overwhelmed. It's the same boy she once had been enamoured with from her school days. Before she has any time to come to terms with this revelation, the knock is at the door. Laura musters all her courage to answer it, and Jim and Tom enter. Jim is surprised to see her, having no idea that Tom even had a sister, and was ignorant of the Wingfields' plans. Laura cannot deal with the social situation and promptly bolts like a deer. This leaves time for Tom and Jim to chat. Jim wants to go into public speaking, and he assures Tom that we're not for the warehouse. Tom concurs, revealing to Jim that he's paid for membership into the Merchant Seamen's Union, rather than his family's electric bill for that month. All those evenings sat at the movies has led Tom to finally seize the reins of his life and go out and have an adventure of his own.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Cheap Caribbean Vacations has got the perfect escape waiting for you.
Vacation planning should feel like a breeze, not a deep dive into countless travel sites searching for the best deal. With Cheap Caribbean's Budget Beach Finder, you can search every destination and every date all in one search.
You're going to save time and money, friends, with the Budget Beach Finder. So say goodbye to your endless scrolling and tab hopping, and say hello to Budget Beach Bliss at your fingertips.
Go to CheapCaribbean.com to try out the Budget Beach Finder and see just how stress-free vacation planning should be.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
It never happens at a good time. The pipe bursts at midnight. The heater quits on the coldest night. Suddenly, you're overwhelmed. That's when Home Serve is here. For $4.99 a month, you're never alone. Just call their 24/7 hotline and a local pro is on the way. Trusted by millions, Home Serve delivers peace of mind when you need it most. For plans starting at just $4.99 a month, go to homeserve.com. That's homeserve.com. Not available everywhere. Most plans range between $4.99 to $11.99 a month your first year. Terms apply on covered repairs.